Good afternoon, everyone. Jacqueline Machard is well known as an international New York Times bestselling author. Her first book, The Deep End of the Ocean, was chosen as Oprah Winfrey's very first book in her book club. It was so wildly successful that Jacqueline's books continue to sell incredibly well. She's a literary writer of not only adult novels, but she writes YA and children's books as well. She has her own imprint, Merit Press. Today, I am pleased to welcome Jacqueline Chard to the show, and she presents her Summer Scribes series. Jacqueline, take it away.
Thank you, Pam. Well, I'm very excited because I am going to be speaking for three consecutive Wednesdays at this time for people who love literature on their lunch break with three writers who are writers that I am the editor and publisher for at the imprint that I'm the editor-in-chief of, which is Merit Press, which is a small literary young adult imprint that has the opportunity to be very picky. And so that's what we have done. And the first one who's here today is named Laura Moe. Laura Moe is the author of a wonderful novel called Breakfast with Neruda. Welcome.
Hello. It's nice to talk to you.
As it is to you. Well, I am going to plunge right into this. I want to ask you a question because I know that you, as I did, I was not 25 when I wrote. Well, I was 25 when I wrote my first book, but way more than that, 10 years later and change before I wrote my first novel. I know that you had a whole career as a high school teacher before you became a writer, a novelist, but what I want to ask you is, did you always treasure that dream?
Yeah, I grew up around books. My parents were readers. We always had full bookshelves in the house, and I always had this dream of seeing a book with my name on the spine. And you know, through high school, I wrote and wrote and wrote a lot. And over the years, I think because I was working, I didn't really have the time to sit down and actually craft a novel. But I wrote a lot of poetry and short stories and had a few of those published. But there was something, I just wanted to be able to write a complete, you know, novel, a whole manuscript, something with heft, I guess. So,
well, it has that, and it also is one of the most beautifully written novels that I've ever read, not just for Merit Press, but any place. And I would like you to describe it. Can you describe it to the listeners? Tell them a little bit about the story and why it was this story at this time.
Okay. Our protagonist is Michael Flynn, and he lives in southeastern Ohio. It's an area for which I'm very familiar because I spent quite a bit of my teaching career there. And he is living in his car. And it's not because he, you know, got thrown out of the house or anything, but because, well, the reason is he got, his mother is a hoarder. But at the same time, he also did get booted out of high school at the end of his senior year because he, inadvertently, he had fireworks in his backpack because his now ex-best friend, Rick, stole his now ex-girlfriend, and he was going to blow up Rick's car at school, which was not a real smart decision. And Michael is otherwise a very bright kid, but he also has a short fuse, no pun intended. But so anyway, the novel begins with him doing his community service because he'd never been in trouble before. The judge decided, well, you know, we're not going to put him in jail for this, but he's doing community service at the high school and helping clean up. And then there he meets a girl named Shelley who is also doing community service all summer. And throughout the story, she's real cagey about why she is there. And, you know, as the story develops, you know, we soon learn more about her and him. So
I was inevitably reminded of The Breakfast Club. And it, in some lovely ways, because of the, mostly, not because the story has is anything like it, and not because detention, though I know I have two 17-year-old daughters, neither of whom, I wish I could knock on wood, has ever gotten in trouble at school so far. And I know that by the end of this broadcast, I will be hearing, even though they aren't in school, I'll be hearing from the principal. But I know that detention hasn't changed that much from their friends' experiences of it. But I was mostly reminded of that wonderful movie because of the way that relationships develop under pressure. And as fiction mm-hmm. writers, we think about that all the time. We take I can't think of the wonderful novelist, Kurt Vonnegut, famously said that you take perfectly nice characters and do absolutely terrible things to them, and in that way they reveal themselves. And I believe that that's true. Under pressure, people form relationships in life and in fiction.
Mm-hmm. They do. That's the thing. I basically spent the whole novel torturing poor Michael and Shelley because they're at odds with each other for parts of it, and at odds with everybody. And
why Neruda? Why the poet Pablo Neruda?
Well, I mean, who could not love Pablo Neruda? But one of the best things that has come out of this is when I hear from teenage readers who have not heard of Pablo Neruda. Now, when I taught, my students always knew who Pablo Neruda was. They had no choice. But one of the most wonderful things I've heard from librarians and teacher friends who've said that, when students have read this, they come in the library and they want to know more about Pablo Neruda. And I guess you'd say maybe Pablo Neruda is my platform. I think everybody... I think there'd be world peace if we all read Pablo Neruda.
You're certainly right about that. The way to world peace is not politics, but possibly poetry. If we all were waking up in the morning and reading some wonderful, life-affirming love poetry, it would be harder for us to think in terms of the ways in which we could possibly destroy and make fun of each other. So
exactly.
Let me ask why. Now I know why is Michael? I live in a neighborhood where minivans and full size vans and SUVs of every description are ubiquitous. Why is he living in a station wagon?
It's interesting because my dad used to have a car. It was the same model car. It was a blue. We called it the Blue Whale. It was his. It was his work car. It was a 1982 blue LTD station wagon. And, he had a nicer car that he didn't, he took, but when he worked, he was an engineer. He sometimes went out with the survey crew, and they would throw all kinds of crap in this poor car. And it was called the Blue Whale. And I don't know, I thought I'd kind of make the car a character in the novel. It's unusual. And it was a car... It was given to him by you'd call him his ex-stepfather. His mother's been married many times and had all three of the kids in their family have different dads. But that's another issue in the book, is he's never met his father. But his brother's father gave him the car. And in a station wagon, you could live in one. They're large enough, especially the older ones. But... Yeah, I
barely remember that era. I think that era was that was on the way out even when I was young,
right.
Which seems like an awfully long
yeah.
time ago. But I do remember the feeling. Why is it? And this is just frankly strange that car. I can remember my parents when I was a very little kid having a station wagon that had fake wood on the side. And
oh yeah.
The kind they sang about in Beach Boys songs. And
yep.
I remember that feeling more spacious to me than minivans feel now, and I have no idea why.
Well, I think because of the back part, my brothers and I used to ride in the back. We had a station wagon when we were younger. It was a 65 Ford Fairlane, And this is before, you know, all the laws came in, and you know, all three of us would be in the back when we'd be traveling, and if it was hot, we'd have the tailgate open. You know, we could dangle our feet off the side, but really all three of us kids could curl up in the back and sleep. So
that's a horror.
I'm
thinking about the safety implications and all the reasons. When I say to my kids, they say, "Ma, this is a dangerous world now." I have to say to them, you know, I grew up in the 60s and 70s. I'm surprised that I'm still alive at all, given what was permitted then. Let me ask you, for people who might be, I know that there are readers out there, but for people who might be writers out there, I would like to know, people always wonder, this is your first novel. Did you experience immediate satisfaction, you went to a publisher, the publisher said yes, and it was just right to go, or did you experience rejection first?
Oh, I had tons of rejection. I mean, rejection is, I had contacted probably 100 agents, and I had a lot of good rejection. You know, I sort of think of them as like gold level because they would compliment the writing, they thought the story was good, but the biggest issue was they didn't quite know what to do with it because it's a little bit strange. You know, it doesn't fit, like it's not dystopian, there's no vampires. I actually had one agent ask me if Michael had a superpower. She goes, well, if
he has
a superpower, she says, if you give him a superpower, I'd be willing to look at it. And I thought, well, his superpower is he survives. But I think part of it is it's not a neat fit. And one of the reasons I chose Merit Press because I went into Plan B. It's like, okay, I've had 100 agents reject me. My next plan is to find a publisher who does not require representation.
Mm.
And I read an article, I think it was Christine Kohler had something on her webpage about Merit Press. And I read the interview that she did with you, and I thought, wait a minute. You know, the gears started turning. It's like, she's describing my novel. You know, it's a contemporary young adult where romance is not the main focus, but it's part of the story, but it's essentially real-life problems. And I was like, ding, 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 ding. And luckily, you know, you bit. And I guess that's the advice I would give is be careful about to whom you send your work because, I think because I had done a little bit of research before I submitted, I knew that my novel was going to be a match for Merit Press. So.
And that is right. What you said is exactly what Merit Press looks for. We want realistic contemporary fiction that is absorbing and exciting and wildly romantic, but not a romance, and adventurous, but not an adventure. And it can have elements even of magic realism, a little bit of magic realism, but is not a fantasy. We want stories that are beautifully realistic and in which teenagers can imagine themselves. And I think if I had to describe Michael's superpower, it would be his great heart. Because I think that he's a character who has, he doesn't sound phony for a teenage male. He sounds exactly the way a teenage male would sound, which I suppose that your having been a high school teacher gives you some experience of that. But also, he has a depth of sincerity that comes through on the page, and I find very moving without being phony.
Yeah, thank you. One of the things my fiction friends, we all think we're highly normal, but my normal friends think I'm a little weird because these people are real to me. And my friend Elizabeth and I, we sit around and talk about Michael and Shelley as if they're like real people. And if anybody overhears our conversation, they're thinking, oh, those poor people. But, they are real to me. And flaws and all. And I've had people ask me if Michael is based on one person, and he's not. He's based on probably all, you know, male and female teenagers that I've known through the years. You know, the teenage years, that's a heartbreaking time to begin with. And then when you have added outside issues, it just layers and layers of it. So, yeah, I guess you're right. His superpower, he just perseveres and he just uses his goodness to help him get through life.
I guess it's true that he does do some bad things through bad judgment, but there is never any doubt that at his core, he's a good person. He's the guy you would want to have on your side and to have your back.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about books and characters, okay?
Okay.
One of my favorite characters in a book remains Jane Eyre. Sometimes when I feel like I want to give up as a writer, as a mother, as a person, I think Jane wouldn't give up, and neither would Charlotte Bronte. I used to keep a picture of Charlotte Bronte by my desk when I had a desk because I thought she had much to overcome, much sorrow, much grief, much worse than my own, and still she persevered. Tell me who some of your favorite characters are and some of your favorite books.
Well, you know, and that was another thing that attracted me to Merrick Press is that your favorite all-time book is A Tree Grows in Brooklyn. And
yes.
I've always loved Francie. I guess I thought, you know, when I first read the book, I was in probably junior high, and I was like, oh, I recognize myself in her, you know, always writing and taking notes and, you know, kind of being an observer of the world. So I guess she's probably one of my favorite characters. And, of course, at the same time, you know, the other side of my personality, I thought of myself as a little bit of Holden Caulfield, too, you know, kind of like a little bit of the cynical side. You know, Jane Eyre is a good one. You know, every time I think I mentioned to you earlier, every time I read a book, it's like, oh, this is now my new favorite book. Oh, this is now my new favorite book.
Comfort that we don't run out of them? We can't be profligate in life that way. We can't always turn to, though I know people who have tried, you can't always turn to a new husband or to a new lover or a new job, but you can always turn to a new story.
Oh, you can, and you can live inside it, and then there's, you know, when you finish, like probably the book that affected me the most recently, it's like I wanted to give up writing after I read it, was All the Light We Cannot See by Anthony Doerr. It's like, okay, I'm never going to write this well. I'm never going to be Anthony Doerr. It's like I might as well just, get a job at Starbucks or something. But, you know, as my friends pointed out, it's like, well, Anthony Doerr can't write like you do either. So
that's right, and you'll never write that the way he did.
Right, right. So, yeah,
I don't know if book characters are real to me. Certainly the book characters that I write are not real to me. But all my children are. My oldest daughter is named Francie because of Tree Grows in Brooklyn. All of my children are named after characters in books except for one of them. And so I guess that in some way those stories have imprinted themselves on my DNA, on my heart, in ways that perhaps other things have not. What book are you reading right now, Laura?
Well, I always have several going. I have one in the car that I'm listening to called Dreaming in English. It's a really good. It's a story about a woman who is from Iran, and she ends up, she's getting ready to. Her visa is about to expire, and a man she knows, you know, good male friend, wants to marry her. So that one is interesting. Young adult, I'm reading Mosquito Land by David Arnold. And then I always have nonfiction. I have like a stack of books next to my bed. I read a lot of literary stuff, like right now, Orhan Pamuk, A Strangeness Inside Me. A friend of mine gave me a copy of that. So I have, it varies, but I guess I'm eclectic in my taste.
I'm reading a wonderful book by a literary author right now called Sons and Daughters of Ease and Plenty by Ramona Ostell. And I just recommend this book so highly. It's about this family of extraordinarily wealthy people who are thrust into the world of impoverished people overnight, and how badly they behave, and yet how much we as readers forgive them. So it, and that's quite a task, to have people behave badly and for us to still feel compassion for them. I want to ask you something that is a little outside the purview of authorship. It's about education. You have a Master's of Fine Arts degree, an MFA.
Right.
I do too. I got mine late in life. I got mine just a few years ago when I was 50, and after I had written many books. You got yours, I believe, not as recently as that. Tell me about your experience and why you think that made you a better writer, if it did. Because there's debate about that.
Yeah, I would agree that an MFA is not a ticket to getting a book published. What an MFA does is it, I think for me as a writer, I think because I was still working, it was in the late 90s, I was still working, but I still had this dream of writing a book. And for me, it was a low residency MFA, so I was able to actually continue working. I gave up a lot of my social life for about 2 years. It's like I had to make choices. But what it taught me was how to get in the habit of writing a long piece, because I had to write a thesis, of course, and it also taught me how important it is to, you know, to just stay with it and finish it and keep doing it, getting in the habit of writing, meeting other writers, and connecting with mentors. And it's just something that it's like, okay, it kind of solidified the whole idea that writing is something that you never really stop learning. Even though I've had the MFA now for almost 20 years, I still go to conferences and workshops. I don't know everything. You can't know everything about writing. But as far as credentials go, it allowed me to be able to teach college classes. It gave me the credentials to do that. But as far as, you know, writing goes, I may have been able to craft a novel on my own without it, but I think the pathway would have taken me longer.
I teach in two MFA programs, and in they're both low residency MFA programs, and they're terrific. One of them is the oldest one, and the other one is very new. And I among my students in both of those programs, there are not a few, but several published authors who, and they're well published, who have, and when I say to them, have you done this strictly for the credential, every one of them says no. I went back because I wanted to grow as a writer. And I think that writers, you don't always hear, I mean, yes, it's certainly true that many professionals in many walks of life do continuing education, but writers are hungry and thirsty to improve. I know that I feel that I learn my craft anew, sometimes to my extraordinary despair, every time I write a novel, and especially every time I revise one.
Right. Yeah. It doesn't get easier. You know, right now I'm working on a novel, and it's like I'm making the same mistakes I always make. I mean, I create, you know, volumes of backstory and throw it out there in the first chapter, and it's like, I've done this since I started writing. It's like, have I not learned anything in all my years? Like, why do I do this? And it's like, you know, here we go again. I've done it again. So,
are you writing another young adult novel? Are you writing an adult novel? What, I mean, you don't have to tell us really what it's about, because I'm sure that that's on the QT. But tell us, I mean, what genre, or not genre, I mean, young adult is not a genre. It's a category. But what
category,
kind of novel are you writing now?
Well, it's, odd because I thought when I wrote Breakfast with Fluid, I thought, okay, you know, that's a novel I can move on. Because I had actually started writing an adult novel, but Michael and Shelley appeared in my dream, and they were like feeding stories. So I wrote a sequel, and I'm actually working also on a third. It's like it has become a three-book series because they just won't shut up. They keep telling me stories. They keep visiting me. So, you know, that's the craziness of being a fiction writer is these sometimes characters, they really don't let you go. And
wow.
So it's, and I've never written a series, so I have no idea what I'm doing.
My author friends tell me often that they feel as though they're somehow that the characters get into, this doesn't happen to me. They feel sometimes that the characters take control and that they're channeling from another experience. Mm-hmm. If I could do that, see, all my characters do if I leave them alone is sit on the couch and pop open a Corona and a bag of Doritos and have a good old time. They don't do a thing. But all my author friends say, they're telling me what to do. I'm pretty prolific, but I'd be much more prolific if my characters would behave that way.
I had, when I was writing the second book of the series, one night I woke up in a bad mood because Shelley had done something horrible to Michael in a dream. And I woke up, and I was mad all day long. I was mad at her. I had to call my friend Elizabeth, and I was like, you won't believe what Shelley did. I ended up using it. But it stayed with me all day because I care about both of these kids. And it's like, what she did was quite in character because she's got some issues as well. And so fiction writers were a little strange. But I do think of myself as just channeling because it's written in first person through the Michael's point of view. And I'm obviously not an 18-year-old boy. So
really?
But.
I have only two questions left for you, but they're
okay.
They're good ones, I hope.
Okay.
Before we leave the writerly issue, if you had to give just one sentence piece of advice to somebody who is writing a book or who hopes to write a novel, what would it be? In one sentence,
read
what would you say to
everything.
That? Read. That's a beautiful
read
thing.
Everything.
Read
everything. The good stuff. Read the bad stuff. You'll learn from the bad stuff. Read everything. That's read. Write.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more. I think that before I ever took graduate studies, and I didn't major in writing at college. I majored in biology. And before I ever did graduate studies, I went to the University of Good Books. And I tried to emulate, which is not to say that I copied, but I tried to emulate my betters. And I still think that there's no better thing for a writer to do than to try to emulate, to do the things well that the people you admire do well. Don't you agree?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
That's actually another question.
I had an exercise I used to do with my students. It was called the imitation exercise, and I would give them passages from I had Faulkner, Hemingway, and who the other writer was, and they would have to study these passages, and they would have to write three scenes imitating these three writers. Fitzgerald was the third one, and they had to kind of sink into like Faulkner, make long sentences that are almost stories by themselves, and then Hemingway they would have to use more heft to their diction. And then with Fitzgerald, he was a little bit kind of in between the two of them. And
I do exactly that thing with my graduate students. I do exactly that thing. And I always tell them, you're not copying it. You're re-experiencing it with your own voice. And by emulating the people you admire, you really do find your own voice. Okay, the last question that I have for you. I live right a few hours across the state from the home where in Amherst, where Emily Dickinson lived, and I was recently in Amherst for a job that I was doing, and Every time I drove past that big federal house, I was moved to tears thinking of Emily and how hers was an extraordinary story of perseverance that no one even knew about, because unlike the Brontes, she wasn't trying to get published during her lifetime. Her favorite word was Massachusetts. That's a pretty good one.
Yeah,
what's your favorite word? And this is how I think I'm going to end my Summer Scribe series every single time, is that I'm going to ask people, the people I'm talking to, what their very favorite word is.
I love the word mellifluous, because the word kind of means what it sounds like. You know, there's a whole melody to it. You know, mellifluous. It's like a word that sort of flowers as you say it. So that's a wonderful word.
Well, Laura, thank you so much. This is Laura Moe, whose book is Breakfast with Neruda, published by Merit Press. I am so delighted to have had you come and talk to me. Next week, I'm going to be talking to Ellen Whitlinger, another Merit Press author, about some of the same kinds of things, but you have helped my Summer Scribe series get off to a wonderful start. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much.
And thank you, Jacqueline Chard, the guest host for Summer Scribe series. Stay tuned next week when Jacqueline Machard and Ellen Whitlinger will be back. Thank you, everyone. Have a great day.